Hello and welcome to the special episode of Label Sessions Presents. So today we are launching a range of new accelerators and innovation programs. Each in its own way responds to the question a lot of leaders are asking us right now, which is how the hell do I make sense of this new world that is emerging around us? With some very big changes coming in the world of politics, big changes in tech and AI, and a general sense that lots of things are just changing faster than maybe leaders expected. Or to put it more bluntly, how do we all respond to the new world order? So let's not go in that deep into that straight away. I'm also joined by Keisha Gahano in London. Welcome, Keisha.
Thank you very much. Super excited to kind of be here and also to intro all of our wonderful label mates.
It's almost like you knew the script. That's very good. So let's introduce who's on the call, Keisha.
Wonderful. Well, first up, we're joined by Alejandra Para Orlandoni, or as like we like to call you, Mappo. So Mappo is a trailblazer in AI governance and responsible tech, shaping the policies that define how businesses and governments engage with artificial intelligence. From her work at Meta and also the US Department of Defense and Quantum Black, to leading responsible AI initiatives at Pastoral Labs. She is at the forefront of navigating the future of responsible technology. Mappo, hello and welcome. Whereabouts in the world are we finding you this morning? And you know, how does the world feel where you are?
Well, first of all, thank you for having me on. I am in the Boston area where it is very rainy and kind of sad looking outside, but there are hints of spring, which is wonderful. The temperature is going up and I feel like this kind of small feeling of hope. I hope it's infectious. I hope it spreads.
That's wonderful. And I feel it definitely happens a lot when kind of spring is just around the corner. Wonderful. Well, next we're joined by Johnny Wood. So Johnny is a strategist who has guided some of the world's biggest brands through their innovation challenges, from crafting foresight-driven strategies for Dell's future of collaboration to reimagining hotel experiences for IHG's Chinese business travelers. We signed Johnny to Label Sessions for his expertise in answering the critical question of what do we do next? Johnny, welcome to the podcast. You're based out of kind of Singapore, the sunny Singapore. And, you know, at the moment, that's where you are. But you've been all around Asia as well. And as we'll probably hear, your accent says kind of, you know, UK. But I wonder, Johnny, how is the world feeling where you are at the moment in Singapore?
Thanks, Keisha. And hey, thanks for having me on. So, yes, I'm Singapore based at the moment. I guess like a lot of places, it's feeling pretty uncertain right now. You know, there is, as I'm sure we're about to spend a lot of time talking, there is a ton of different things changing right now. And that is very much being reflected here. I mean, in Singapore's case, it's, you know, it's such an interesting country and how it's positioned between East and West, between kind of China and America. It's in an interesting position amidst all this change. So uncertain feels probably a fair description, but hopefully some hope as well, as Mappo would echo.
Yes, definitely. I think a lot of us talking about uncertainty, but something perhaps around the corner, something blooming. But yes, last but not least, in London, we have Richard Hale. So Richard is one of our kind of key global pioneers of AI as a creative tool in brand design. So he is a creative disruptor and design consultant with a passion for inspiring others to kind of think differently about kind of personal and also professional life. So with a background in design at Google and the brains behind Bacardi X, so the pioneering innovation lab, Richard embraces the kind of fusion of human ingenuity with technological efficiency to drive meaningful change. Richard, welcome. Hello. So you and I are both in London. And I guess apart from the obvious grey and cloudy, as kind of London usually is, kind of how does the world feel for you?
Hello, Keisha. Hello, everyone. Lovely to be here. Thank you for having me. Look, it's gosh, wow. More turmoil. Turmoil. Every day we start with more turmoil. So, yeah, you just summed up there. Bacardi, we used to teach agility of the mind. And I think no more so now than do we need an agile mind to just be able to cope daily, let alone in work. So it's an extraordinary time to be alive, extraordinary time to be talking about what we're going to talk about here. And yeah, I'd like to think that technology could make our lives better in some way, but it's going to be brilliant to go through the conversation today. And yeah, we're stuck in the middle, right? We've got Johnny, Mappo and us. So no, it's going to be a brilliant discussion, I'm sure.
Nice. Let's dive into that a bit, actually, because Mappo, your accelerator is all focused on responsible innovation, which is a term some people may not be familiar with. Some people have been really wrestling with what it means in practice. What is it about responsible innovation that you think that excites you right now, and you think is an important thing to talk about right now?
Yeah, it's a great question, and I guess the one word I would use at this moment is a redo, and I'll explain what I mean by that. So as you all already alluded to, for better or worse, especially tech right now, it's unambiguously intertwined with geopolitics. I mean, it's arguably been that way for years, but there's no mistake now. And with that comes, I think, a lot of turbulence and uncertainty, which is probably one of the themes of this conversation. And I think to some, this brings anxiety and fear. But to me, uncertainty means an opportunity to create, to shape and to define. And I think this is a good thing for the field of responsible innovation. I think there are certainly headwinds, political, social, otherwise, that may not have been there yesterday or maybe not as strong. But I think these sorts of headwinds, these kinds of constraints also force responsible innovation practitioners to get back to I have to apologize for using this quite overused term, but to get back to first principles, because to me, one of the biggest misses of previous responsible innovation trends was this over-reliance on tools like checklists and audits and more generally retrospective post hoc corrective mechanisms, things that really make you kind of feel risk averse, uncreative, non-agentic. And they're not aligned with the ethos of innovation itself. Now, to be clear, these sorts of tools have their place and can be quite important and useful. But wouldn't it be cool if responsible innovation programs facilitated innovation as much as they fostered responsibility? And so these days, I'm really excited to work with organizations to kind of flip that old approach on its head. Because to me, responsible innovation in the end is about making great decisions, great investments, creating impact you can be proud of. And by the way, in my view, that's just innovation, because irresponsible innovation kind of tends to eat itself. And so really, to me, it's about shaping strong, solid decisions around product strategy, experience design, ways of working, creating incentives, and channeling that spirit of innovation in a way that kind of hopefully brings about better circumstances for people, better future for your organization and the communities you serve, and creating fortuitous cycle from that. And the uncertainty that I think we're seeing today, the reason I'm kind of excited about it, is that it provides this redo moment, this opportunity to reframe what responsible innovation means and what it looks like.
Yeah. It's a really interesting point, the kind of point of redo, or the kind of never waste a good crisis, I guess, is the old phrase in terms of for all these things. And Johnny, it's interesting too. So your accelerator is focused on how we set up futures functions and how organizations think about the future in a kind of intentional way. What is it about that got you interested in that in the first place? Because it is an unusual interest. And then what is it about that excites you currently?
Well, so I guess I've always worked in my career, always kind of in and around corporate innovation, which in essence is kind of how do you help big companies move faster? Really, how do you help them kind of get ready for what's next? So that's, I guess, kind of whatever label you put on top of that, whether you call it just innovation or responsible innovation or futures or foresight or some other buzzword, fundamentally, that's what the job is, help big companies kind of get ready for what's next. So that's definitely where the interest comes. And for me, it is, I guess, where I'm interested in and kind of the angle I'm really excited to be partnering with you guys on is thinking about, well, how do you help companies think about the future in new ways that are highly pragmatic and actionable? Because I guess I think futures thinking and foresight, it's kind of got a reputation of being about these very kind of fun, crazy scenarios about 30 years time, or maybe a really fun to read and interesting to debate kind of trends deck. But either way, it's quite hard to do anything with that. And that's not to say kind of that pure foresight doesn't have a good purpose, because it absolutely does in terms of preparing companies or forcing companies to think about things they're not thinking about. But I guess where I'm most interested personally is absolutely on pushing that kind of pragmatic and actionable piece, because this is preaching to the choir, but what it's not about is obviously perfect prediction and kind of knowing what's coming. But it is about the ability to see change coming and then act decisively. That's what I think the key is. So it's not about providing certainty, but clarity about possibilities and possible paths forward, because good foresight for me is not a trends deck or a set of scenarios. It drives transformation. And it's about taking actions today that give you better options tomorrow. And really what I think it's about, and kind of what the whole, my whole accelerator about actually, is really about building organizational resilience. It's about being able to react to change better than everyone else. And I think to do that is about kind of looking ahead and thinking about that with some of the techniques of kind of futures and foresight. But that's, again, not to say I must think 30 years out. Actually, it's a lot closer in given all the change that's coming. So I guess that's a brief moment on kind of what excites me around this.
Yeah, it's interesting to dive into that a bit more in a moment. First of all, though, Richard, it's interesting your area. So your accelerator is focused on harnessing AI, in particular around customer experience and these kind of challenges that cut right across an organization. What is it that excites you about that area? What is it that you think means that this is an interesting thing for leaders to be thinking about and organizations to be thinking about right now?
Yeah, I think there's so many interesting spaces, and just riffing off of Mapo and Johnny there, I've worked in innovation for a long time, and this idea, and Mapo, you pointed it out, this responsible innovation. Isn't innovation irresponsible? Isn't that the joy of innovation? And then Johnny, just like you were saying, you know, when I've worked in the places I've worked, and you've got this sort of 5-10 year plan, and then COVID came, and then a war came, and then Trump's arrived again. So I don't know how we're supposed to plan for these times, exactly. These modern times. It's a sort of five-day plan, a 10-day plan. But yeah, specifically, Nick, to answer the question of consumer, I don't think as brands we spend enough time really genuinely thinking about consumer. And so I'm so excited to be working in this way with these tools to be able to expedite findings, validate findings, unify findings, to move quickly, to give those points of view back to brands. And find truth again. You know, when I worked at Google, it was epic. We had all that data stack. We had all that data. We had the search box. The search box that knew more about you than you knew about you. And I just think with these tools, yeah, to be able to expedite potential processes that would take 6 months, a year to run. And by the time you've got to a set of solutions, the solutions would be old anyway. So I just think, yeah, thinking about these tools and how they can expedite and change for the good, what brands do and how brands act, how governments act and what they do. The working in this way is it's extraordinarily powerful to build action, like Johnny said, that word that I think we've lost a lot of. Action. Find action. Make decisions, but validate it with quantum qual. So yeah, look, it's a really exciting time to be working to support friction in business and turn those traditional blockers into quick enablers.
Okay. It's interesting here. So one of the questions that, you know, so when we catch up with the client base every month and we talk about different things that are going on, and I think there is a real sense for lots of leaders just now, which is they are kind of stuck because they kind of see some of the possibilities, but they also feel like everything changes as soon as they start to step into a place. So I kind of wrote down, with Johnny's phrase there, act decisively. You know, it's interesting, how should someone think through that? So if you're leading an organization right now, there's all these things going on, how do you start to build, whether it's a plan or whether it's a sort of an action plan, like how do you start to move through the world right now and think about acting decisively?
Who's that for? Who's the question for?
I see you want to jump forward. Go for it, Richard.
Oh, of course. Yeah, look, we saw it again. I think when I was working at Bacardi and we started to do transformation, and it felt like we aimed too high. It felt like we aimed at business transformation. But I think the important thing was the lower down version of people. So I think it's just engaging people and pulling people in. You've almost got to invert the triangle. I remember doing it for the leaders. You know, it's like mission and vision from the company is the small tip and then people at the bottom. And I think, yeah, it's got to go back to that. What small action orientated changes can we start to put in place that we can learn from today to show a benefit of why tomorrow we can do it again and again and again. But I think, yeah, I fundamentally believe that we start too big. And I think these tools allow us to act with action now, to be able to expedite, but to be able to demonstrate. And I think that's it. It's just got to be demonstrative. We've sat in those massive meetings with 60 slide presentations talking about transformation. And you know full well that the leaders have got their fingers in the ears and the people are just going, this will never happen. So I think small incremental change is how I see it. And I think these tools can, say, make and lead to better decision making.
It's interesting to draw that out, though, because sometimes you can be a leader who's also trying to drive a change. So in terms of actually you want people on the ground to start to make different choices and things. Does that change the kind of the way you go after it? Mappy, you must have faced into this a lot in the kind of more responsible innovation space, because to some level, you're always going to have to be disrupting something that's up and working somewhere in the business quite well. So like, what's the kind of framework or way of thinking that through?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are a lot of different ways to frame it based on the context of the organization you're working with. But I think broadly, one of the things I find most useful is, and Richard kind of alluded to this, there are these, you know, high flying, very esoteric goals that we set for organizations. And that's great. It's really important and I think valuable to have these inspirational goals or endpoints or visions. And then on the flip side, you know, you have folks coming in, working, doing their day-to-day tasks. They know what they're doing today. They might know what they're doing tomorrow. But you ask them to connect to that vision and help themselves to understand how they contribute to it. And it's actually quite hard. So there's, I think, a lot of work that you can do, a lot of enabling that you can do by helping to translate some of these kind of more esoteric concepts into more concrete objectives or you know, goals that people can actually connect their daily work to, and share as much context as you can with people who are actually doing and executing the work. And if they, you know, they're presumably talented folks, they understand the objectives that you're working toward, they'll go. They'll go. They will work toward those goals and toward those objectives. And then I think it's really on a lot of the leadership folks to continue connecting that daily work, those objectives, back up to this, you know, whatever the esoteric kind of more ethereal goals might be. And be willing and able to assess whether or not the work is actually moving the organization in the right direction, and then change direction as necessary. So, you know, it sounds a little bit mundane, but it's a lot of communication work, I think, and framing and, you know, translating ideas to actions. And it's the difference between people saying like, oh yeah, our company does this, I'm working on this other thing, that's great, to shifting to something that's more like, hey, our company is working on this, and this is how I'm contributing to whatever that thing is. Mm-hmm. So I think just helping people to make those connections is really important. And then just kind of letting people go.
I think, Mappa, that word communication is so important, because you got to do both. You have to do this, the small incremental kind of things today that, you know, have dramatic results. And absolutely, you got to have that mission value of, what do we believe about the future? What do we want to be? Why are we here? Where are we going? And connecting those two is what so many corporates are terrible at. You know, the ones I've worked in or advised, many of them, they think a sort of one-time annual kind of strategy cascade is sort of ticks the box, where you give some very token connection between mission, but really it's just a set of KPIs that, you know, that, you know, very tactical, frankly, for that year, typically financial, and very unaspirational from an employee point of view. And in theory, there's a cascade down to kind of your job, as it were, wherever you may be in that organization. Really, what that just means is your manager's manager has sort of had the same spiel, and it kind of gets passed down. It's not genuine kind of translation, but a few companies do it amazingly in terms of their mission and their values and their purpose and how that connects. And that's a constant exercise. It's an easy thing to sort of say. It's a very hard thing to do. I just see most companies doing it very badly.
Yeah. It's interesting though, isn't it, Johnny? Because there's definitely been a spectrum in terms of people leading innovation and people leading futures as to how they feel about how close they should be to the rest of the business. I used to run a more traditional consultancy, and we had a frankly, in London, just pretty much a WeWork space, but ended up becoming like the business became so much about hosting all these teams. You wanted to get away from their in-house team to go and like think differently and do different things. And then suddenly, strangely enough, had a problem when they were trying to get the rest of the business to do anything around it.
I was about to say, then you get into that fascinating question of how close, and Richard, you're there too, obviously, of like how close do you want your innovation team, if that's even what you're going to want to call it, because that kind of implies innovation doesn't happen elsewhere. But if you are going to have a kind of a team who fundamentally is thinking about tomorrow, put it that way, as opposed to the core business that's focused on today, and those are two very different mindsets that take very different behaviors, etc., it's a fascinating question how close do you want them to be? Not too close, because otherwise they're just free resource for the core business, and not too far away, in which case nothing ever translates. Mm-hmm. So it's a classic problem.
Yeah.
And again, Johnny, sorry, Nick, not to jump in, but I loved your term strategy cascade. I thought that sounded like some beautiful ethereal place. Welcome to the strategy cascade. And let's not forget, right, so where I'm from, I've been so fortunate to spend, you know, equal amount of time in client side as well as agency side. Mm. When you do the strategy cascade in the business, that then's got to translate into the agency that supports your innovation.
Yeah.
That's almost an impossible task. It's almost an impossible task.
Yeah. Let's look into one of the other things that actually this Richard on the uses of AI, because there is more of a pushback now to use of AI across all things in innovation, product development, advertising and media. And so I know inevitably some of the people listening to this will be thinking, hey, I've seen AI get used in these use cases, and it's pretty much a way of just serving up slop. And it's pretty much a way of kind of making everything quite average. What's your kind of take on that and your response to that?
Yeah, no, it's too true. And it's lazy AI versus thoughtful AI, right? And I still think, you hear it all the time, especially, say, from where I've been, agency side, I think it's the verbiage of take away, take away, take away. It's going to take away jobs. It's going to take away creativity. It's just this take away word, whereas I got the opportunity to sit and use the tools, and I've seen it as nothing but an additive. But I think I've had the opportunity to spend time trying to change that default output. And I think you can see it now. It's so funny whenever I see writing. So watch out, you lot. I'm watching you. But whenever you see that little vertical bar, the horizontal bar that ChatGPT loves putting into text, it's just a surefire that somebody has gone lazily to save time. And I think that's it. I think we've just got to start to educate that there is a way of using AI in a lazy way for efficiencies. And there is a way of using AI in a very thoughtful way to better critical thinking. And I think it's just getting bad press. It's getting bad press at the moment and will continue to get bad press. But yeah, I see it taught in the right way. It's just an additive. It's an extra. But I think there is this thing in changing that default. You know, we're going to a place of general intelligence. General's never a good word in the land of innovation or creativity. So I think everything about it now is just the wrong nomenclature. We're using the wrong words. We're using the wrong sentiments. I'm very excited to be on the other side of the fence of a true believer in these tools. But I see why there is so much angst and fear towards what it can do. It's just technology. It's just a tool. That's it. Period. Full stop. It's how you use it. It's your behaviors towards it that is the most important part. Sorry, that was a bit soapbox.
Go for it.
I have to jump in. I'm really upset that ChatGPT loves using the M-dash, because I love the M-dash. I've been an avid M-dash user for years and years.
That's what M-dash was. I had to ask it. I kept saying, what is this line that you're using? Oh, it's the M-dash. Oh, thank you very much. Can we make sure we don't use the M-dash, please?
I love the M-dash. I'm so sad that it's now a giveaway. It prompts the question in my mind, wait, is my brain basically AI? Because I love to use the M-dash. But no, I think Richard, the points you just made are so important. And it's one of the things that I spend a lot of time on, which is, when you're creating technologies to assist you in doing this or that, or to accomplish this or that goal, create the right tool for the job, design the right tool for the job. And with that comes a lot of additional questions. But I do think that there's a tendency right now, probably because it's a new tool, to use AI in in not the right ways for the job. I think a lot of time people don't even know what the job is that they're trying to use AI for in the first place, which is its own, you know, kind of its own kind of challenge. But I think you're absolutely right that really understanding the nature of whatever the tool is, whether it's AI or something else, and really understanding the nature of the job that you're trying to do, the task that you're trying to accomplish, and making sure those things are complementary and work together. And then also, you know, when you scale it out, because a lot of these tools you start to use not just in one-offs, but at scale. Make sure that whatever that looks like is something we actually want in an organization or in the world.
Yeah.
No, I think it's so interesting. And Richard, I wanted to pick up your point. I totally agree from an AI point of view that absolutely the focus is on efficiency, and that is opportunity, yes. But also actually the white space currently anyways is around that kind of creative, that additive piece. And as an individual, that's a great choice to have. But in a corporate context, you don't often get that choice, right? In terms of both the tools you're allowed to use, but also critically, just how your leaders think about AI, because you'll be having these conversations on a daily basis, I imagine. But certainly, leaders are not interested in that more creative additive side right now, anyway. Certainly, within C-suites within big corporates, you know, the thought of being able to cut workforces, the thought of efficiency is like crack, right? And it is. It's fascinating for them. So I think it's so context specific, kind of what choices you get as an individual as well. So,
yeah, sorry, Nick, I know you want to ask again, but just to riff off that, Johnny, as well. I did a talk the other day, and it was the death by a thousand cuts of KPI.
Yeah.
Let's not forget, that's technology, right? That was technology. That's just technology being able to demonstrate something. And I think it is, it's creativity always sits at the heart of this problem, whether it's a KPI, whether it's a GPT, it's just technology. And I think when technology isn't understood, that's where the problem comes. I remember when I was working and it's like, oh, which KPI should we align it to? Should we align it to these 10? Yeah, let's align success to 10 KPIs. Yeah, no, let's not do that. That's exactly right. Let's time out.
And actually, one of the things I was going to pick up was one of the other conversations we're kind of having, which is maybe because of the journey people have been on, is that there's a lot of leaders now who kind of came through some form of the digital revolution. And they're quite conscious there's a lot of things that we just accepted as just technology, as so to speak, that they then get to a point where they realize, well, I wish we'd done that differently. Or actually, I wish we'd thought through the consequences of the tools we were deploying to our teams or the way we were building products in certain ways. So I was going to start off with Mappo on that one, which is... one of the big areas of change has been new technologies like AI coming into product stacks, coming into the way we might do marketing and such like. I was just wondering, as a sort of starting point, how can you start to think through where the great things about that are going to be and where some of the potential dangers of that are going to be?
Yeah, it's the age old question of responsible innovation, I suppose. There's a phrase that a friend of mine said, and then I've repeated it ever since I heard it, because I think it's exactly right. The way that you kind of start thinking through consequences and then making decisions based on those things and, creating hopefully a good product or shaping a great service that you're proud of, it's a messy but not actually very hard process. It's messy, but it's not hard. And it's messy because there's imperfect information. There are questions you ask to which you will not have great answers. In the end, it's kind of like product 101 work. Understand the problem you're trying to solve. Understand the people whom you're trying to serve with that product. What key design choices you might have to make, key capability choices you might have to make, set up ways to measure different types of impact, not just on a particular individual user, but maybe on a collective, maybe your entire user community, maybe on the communities that those communities are connected to, and then iterate. And all of that is really fundamental product development work. It's not new, it's not magical, it's just asking maybe a couple of different questions along the way and caring about, you know, maybe some of the second or third order consequences of what your product is doing. But I will say one of the biggest challenges that I see, and you kind of alluded to it just within your question, Nick, was that a lot of folks, a lot of organizations will launch a product and then, you know, years later realize like, oops, we totally didn't think about one thing. And really where a lot of those oops moments come from are in fundamentals of the product. For example, like the business model behind it. It's not like, you know, the color of the font or, you know, a particular, you know, graphic that the product is showing. It's something much more fundamental, like the business model. And so that's why, you know, for responsible innovation to work well, it's ideal if you're thinking about it from the beginning. It just makes the whole thing a lot easier and a lot less painful so that you don't have those big oops moments that, you know, aside from, you know, causing a bunch of disruption in an organization, end up being very expensive in the long run. That's where you end up with huge, huge, huge legal teams and huge, huge, huge PR teams and huge, huge, huge policy teams, because you realize that you've kind of created a big mess around you that you're not going to be able to like really clean up, because there's something so fundamental to your product that you can't really disappear without disappearing the whole product. So, you know, I think this messy but not hard thing is really true. It gets messy. The questions aren't really hard. They're quite fundamental, kind of basic product development. But if you're kind of careless in the beginning, you'll pay for it in the end at some point. And so will the people around you.
It's really interesting. I don't know if you've picked this up, Johnny, and other things you're doing, but one of the reasons I think we're getting so many questions from, or one of the sparks for lots of the conversations around the futures function, how we're thinking about the future just now, is quite often a challenge that's coming in from a finance director. And I think it's because what's happening is investors are so much more conscious of going back to kind of first principles to go, why the hell would this company still exist in 5 years' time than they were a few years ago? Or this new product you're working on, Is there not a risk in there as well that comes forward? It's quite an interesting thing around the futures as a response to risk, as well as being around the kind of exciting future.
Yeah, definitely. And fear is definitely a driver of that from CFOs for sure. I mean, for futures work as well. I mean, I love the idea of that old Andy Grove idea of like productive paranoia, which I think is a wonderful term. And in kind of this context of always think someone's out there trying to steal your lunch, right? And I think that is actually a great motivator to make sure you are always thinking, well, hang on, what might happen and what might come eat my lunch and disrupt my business? And what are we doing about to make sure it doesn't happen, right? What are we doing to make sure we're always learning? And to Richard's earlier point, that doesn't mean a sort of big transformation piece. That means constant small things, right, that are pointing you in that right direction, that are equipping you to kind of change. Mm-hmm. But it's so interesting because I think you can, given the sort of the velocity of change that it feels like there is right now, you can totally say it feels super weird to even be talking about foresight or futures when I can't even tell what next week looks like, right? Given the sort of the pace of change right now. But actually, I do think given that change, that makes it all the more valuable right now to have what foresight gives you, which is that kind of adaptability, that kind of organizational resilience.
Interesting. Rich, I just want to just bring that to life a little bit, I guess, in terms of, you talked before about agility of the mind and AI kind of helping that in some way. You know, thinking directly around some of the customer experience challenges we're facing into in this accelerator, and actually got one live just now too. You know, how does that come to life for people? How does this way of working actually, you know, how are things different now than they would have been if you were taking on those kind of challenges 18 months ago?
And it's extraordinary, just to riff off again where everybody's been. It's these overlooked soft skills, right? We've all sit in business that try and sprinkle some money on L&D programs to teach people hard skills. But say, when we were from Google into Bacardi, it was more about the soft skills of teaching agility, teaching fluidity, teaching, again, not wanting to quote it, but nothing good grows in the comfort zone. Right. It was continually trying to push people out of that comfort zone. But we know the first barrier to come out of the comfort zone is fear. And there's so much fear around at the moment. And remember, the next thing to the fear zone when you burst out is learning. So we're having trouble, right? Because there is so much fear. There's so much bad press, not just about tech, but the world. So we are in this vacuum of fear. But I think it is. ever more now, the skills of your workforce are the most surely the most imperative thing is what they can deliver from just who they are and what they bring to work other than a set of skills. Look, the marketplace is now awash with people with epic skills. And so we know that hard skills are easy to come by right now and could probably go there's people probably ready to sell their souls, but it's surely the soft skills, which is the most important. And again, how glorious I was able to build a new skill set and look fear in the eye and say, right, how can I bust through this? And I did, and I came out the other side. But yeah, you can see fear coming down from CFOs, from business leaders, but you can see fear coming up. And I must say, saying no, you can't use ChatGPT surely is not the answer right now. We need to be learning. We need to be testing. Yes, of course, we need to be responsible with the decisions we make. But I think, yeah, that fear coming down from above, I don't think it's coming down in the right way.
Yeah.
Well, and that's right? What I love. I mean, Richard, just to that point you were making earlier about sort of soft skills, 100%. And that's what I love about one of the things I love about the advent of AI, which is, and I'm not one of those people who sort of believes, oh, hard skills like coding go away, like those are still super important. But, you know, as a humanities graduate, I love the fact that actually it's your ability to speak human that actually is going to be one of the key differentiators in, you know, it's your emotional skills, et cetera, your emotional intelligence that's going to be one of the key differentiators. So I'm a big fan of that.
Good.
I'm sorry, it's me again. Mappo, linking it to irresponsible, I promise you, I did some research early on, the amount of energy used on a Google search compared to a ChatGPT prompt. I feel so irresponsible right now because I'm using it every day. And I just would hate to think of the server farms that I'm keeping warm at night.
Yep.
So there's so much to consider. It's epic. This has been brilliant.
Excellent. So let's wrap up here. If you want to speak to us about any of these accelerators mentioned here, reach out to us at labelsessions.com and also at all of our various different social handles. I feel like we're on everyone under the sun, Keisha. We will share more on the progress of these accelerators on our episodes, our weekly episodes of Label Sessions Presents. But for now, goodbye.